The voters cast their ballots. Our old president will now become our new president. Donald Trump claims victory.
I'm a Catholic first, and I'm an American second.
I don't like the division. I want the country to come together.
We are in the swing states talking to citizens about how and why they made their voting decisions. Our expert panel joins us to give us election analysis from a Catholic perspective. Will this election have an impact on the fate of those hostages still held by Hamas? We talk to the father of one of the American hostages still in captivity. And we go to Texas to see the famous painted churches decorated to honor a rich Czech immigrant heritage. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president.
The American voters have spoken. Former President Donald Trump is now once again President-elect Trump. Only the second time in U.S. history a president has won two non-consecutive terms in office. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Not since Grover Cleveland won a second non-consecutive term in 1893 has America seen a former president return to the White House. And Donald Trump makes that history as he won a resounding victory on Tuesday night. In the end, it was not even close. Here's a look at the state and electoral votes each candidate won. Republican red, Democrat blue. Of the necessary 270 electoral votes needed, Trump has racked up 295 votes. At the time, we record this program with a little more vote counting to come from Arizona and Nevada. Vice President Kamala Harris has won 226 electoral votes at this time. Perhaps both candidates surprised the race was not closer as the polls had predicted.
Well, I want to thank you all very much. This is great. These are our friends. We have thousands of friends in this incredible movement. This was a movement like nobody's ever seen before. And frankly, this was, I believe, the greatest political movement of all time. There's never been anything like this in this country and maybe beyond.
An ecstatic crowd of supporters greeted Donald Trump and his family in the wee hours of the morning on Wednesday at the Palm Beach County Convention Center when it became clear that he had won a resounding victory in the race to become the 47th president of the United States. As the numbers trickled in over the next hours, Trump won every one of the battleground states, made gains over his previous races in other states across the country, and became the first Republican presidential candidate in 20 years to win the popular vote. In her concession speech at her alma mater, Howard University in Washington, D.C., Vice President Kamala Harris said she called President-elect Trump to pledge to him a peaceful transition of power. She also struck a somber tone, acknowledging the disappointment felt by her supporters.
My heart is full today. My heart is full today, full of gratitude for the trust you have placed in me, full of love for our country, and full of resolve. The outcome of this election is not what we wanted, not what we fought for, not what we voted for. But hear me when I say, the light of America's promise will always burn bright.
On Thursday, speaking from the Rose Garden, President Joe Biden also promised a smooth transition to the next administration.
The people vote and choose their own leaders, and they do it peacefully. And we're in a democracy. The will of the people always prevails. Yesterday, I spoke with President-elect Trump to congratulate him on his victory. And I assured him that I'd direct my entire administration to work with his team to ensure a peaceful and orderly transition. That's what the American people deserve.
While the Trump majority expanded across almost all demographic groups and geographical areas, it got a huge boost from the Latino community. Trump flipped one county in particular, Starr County in South Texas, the most Hispanic county in the nation, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. A longtime Democratic stronghold, voters there had not backed a Republican presidential candidate in decades. The main reasons this time around, the economy and border security.
It was mainly probably the economy. The economy was real bad. It's real bad, still real bad. We live here by the border. Only the people that live here by the border know what's going on, right? So that's why that was my main thing that I voted for him.
Even those Latinos in Starr County who backed Harris had a critique for the Democratic Party, saying Democrats were perceived as not paying enough attention to the working class.
You know, we've seen a lot of efforts from Republican groups come into the community, canvass, block walk, knock on doors. I know that the Democratic Party does that too, but, you know, we can't wait for a big election to have those conversations. By that point, it's too late.
Beyond Texas, which no one ever thought would go blue for Harris, there was an expectation of a much tighter race in the battleground states. On Election Day, we dispatched our EWTN News in Depth reporters to two key swing states, Pennsylvania and North Carolina, to talk to voters at polling places and evening watch parties. Our team coverage on what we heard from voters begins with reporter Mark Irons in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
There was high voter turnout around the country, and the critical swing state of Pennsylvania was no exception, as the final vote count here helped solidify a Donald Trump presidential victory.
I believe in, you know, most of his policies.
At the end of the day, I'm happy with the outcome.
We spoke with Pennsylvania voters pleased the country picked the former president again.
I think he did a good job last time he was in.
And he wants to do what's best for our country.
But the morning after the results came in, we also heard from supporters of Vice President Kamala Harris reacting to defeat.
I'm extremely concerned about the direction of this country.
We're going to accept the results of the election, unlike Trump in 2020. We're going to play fair.
Thomas Kimberly Dawes and his wife had spent the week before Election Day volunteering for the Harris campaign around Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Dawes reflects on what's next for his party.
Which is the Democratic Party over the last 20, 25 years. We've lost our base in the working class, and we've got to get back to fundamentals with them.
Whether Democrats or Republicans, people in the working class have always played a big part in the industrial strength of America. And though there is no longer production on the grounds of the shuttered Bethlehem Steel Corporation, about 60 miles north of Philadelphia, the political leanings around here almost always indicate who will win the White House. For decades, this place was a national leader in steel production. Of course, nowadays, all Americans look to Pennsylvania to see what voters are thinking every presidential election, in particular in this part of the state, in a particular county, where for more than 100 years, voters have almost perfectly picked who will be president. Northampton County voters have correctly chosen the U.S. president in all but three elections since the early 1900s. The county went to Trump in 2016, Biden in 2020, and now back to Trump. We spoke with county voters near St. Anne Catholic School, which served as a polling station.
So my identity really is rooted in my Catholicism, my practice of the faith.
By the adjacent church, we met with parishioner Mark Naperkowski. His vote was guided by Catholic teaching, which calls for the protection of preborn children. With that in mind, he supported Trump.
He is going to do less damage, I believe, in that realm than his opponent, Harris.
Naperkowski helps run a pro-life ministry at St. Anne Parish. He believes at both the church and state level across the country, a pro-life mission must advance.
We need to really value every human life and give moms and women and families an opportunity to raise their families with the resources that are, you know, that we can provide.
In Pennsylvania, Election Day 2024 will be memorable for one voter we spoke with, but not because of the outcome. This election was a significant first for Jackson Pine, who became a U.S. citizen last year.
Yeah, first election in my whole life. It's my first election. I'm very proud because if it was somewhere different, I don't think I would have had the opportunity to vote.
His vote went to the Democratic ticket. Pine and other Liberians were helped by immigration policies during the presidency of Bill Clinton that allowed them to flee their war-torn country in Africa and come to America.
How does it make you feel to be an American here voting?
I feel very happy, proud, and words cannot tell it all because I know what I went through. 23 years surviving in this country to become a citizen. It wasn't just an easy task, but with God above, we were able to come true. So I'm very happy to be an American.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
I'm Rasal Rages in Charlotte, North Carolina. North Carolina, a crucial battleground state with 16 electoral votes, glowed red on the map as former president and soon to be 47th president Donald Trump wins in the state. According to the Associated Press, two factors contributed to his victory. Republican voters in the Tar Heel state cast ballots in greater numbers than 4 years ago, while Democratic turnout sagged. The morning after Election Day, we asked people in downtown Charlotte for their reactions.
Well, I didn't want this, but I kind of expected it. Like, the Democrats didn't run the greatest campaign or the best candidate or do anything we kind of like, so what can you do?
Who knows what rights they'll have tomorrow or the day after that, but what I know to be true is that when push comes to shove, we care about each other.
You know, I think together, in the end, we all kind of come together with solutions that work for everyone.
North Carolina has a track record of counting votes relatively quickly. This year was no different, despite challenges brought by Hurricane Helene to the western part of the state. In one of the hard-hit communities in Asheville, even as residents are still recovering from devastation, they showed up at polling sites to get their votes in early.
I think it is an important thing to do for seeing long-term recovery in places like this.
I'm really devoted to cast my vote, but I think, you know, I think a lot of people feel that way. But obviously, anytime you have something this cataclysmic, it's going to disrupt people's lives.
The night before Election Day, 20 minutes away from downtown Charlotte, a special holy hour for the election was held at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church.
I just have had so many people in my parish tell me how anxious they are about everything. I wanted them to find some peace here and some strength in Christ and renew their faith.
Parishioners share their intentions with us.
We were here to pray to the Lord and to put our trust in Him that He will give us the best leaders.
Just praying for a peaceful, honest election and, of course, peace in our country.
One, I prayed for the intention for an end to abortion and a respect to marriage.
An election that promotes pro-life values.
And family values.
Family values.
Yes. Yeah.
Give it up to God, and it's all in His hands.
On election night, after polls closed in North Carolina, students at Belmont Abbey College anxiously waited for results.
We made our way here to Belmont Abbey College. I'm joining some students here for their election watch party. Yeah!
The student commons was filled with cheering and some booing.
You know, it's great. I love seeing the energy from my fellow students.
Very excited, looking forward to like seeing what happens and, you know, hoping for the best.
Number one thing is that Christ is, king of the country.
The resounding message at Belmont Abbey College, Christ is King, as students prayed for our country and its next leaders. This resonates with Bishop Michael Martin's words. As Bishop of the Diocese of Charlotte, he reminds us this election season to return to the word of the Lord.
I would ask all of us to consider whether or not we are filling our minds and hearts with the right message. And to me, the right message is always the gospel of Jesus Christ.
He cautions the faithful of overindulging in television and social media and being exposed to negative ideologies.
And that is so counter to the message of Christ and the message of the church. It's not us and them, it's us. The more we're engaged, the more impact we have, and the more we can bring the good news to bear in our civic lives.
Rasal Rages, EWTN News in Depth.
By the time all the votes are in, the Republican Party might have control of both houses of Congress as well for a clean sweep. In the Senate, Republicans have taken the majority, gaining four seats, ousting longtime Democratic incumbent senators in Ohio, Montana, and Pennsylvania, and picking up a seat in West Virginia with the retirement of Senator Joe Manchin. The tally is currently 53 Republicans to 45 Democrats, including two independents who caucus with Democrats, with two Senate seats still to be decided in tight races in Arizona and Nevada. With late votes still being counted on the West Coast, particularly in California, and some other races elsewhere too close to call, there is not yet a determination of which party will control the House of Representatives. But things are trending Republican. In the 435-seat chamber, 218 seats are needed for the majority. As we tape this program, Republicans have won 211 seats and Democrats 199. 25 seats remain to be called. We've also been tracking the 10 states that had abortion amendments on their ballot this week. Pro-lifers are claiming victory in three of those states, the first pro-life state victories since Roe v. Wade was overturned. All of the pro-abortion measures in the 10 states sought to enshrine abortion as a so-called right into their state constitutions. It passed in seven of those states, as you can see here on our map: Missouri, Arizona, Colorado, Maryland, Montana, New York, and Nevada. But three states have bucked the trend, where voters rejected the extreme abortion amendment. We take a closer look now at how Florida, Nebraska, and South Dakota prevailed with pro-life victories. Pro-lifers have succeeded at the state level for the first time since the Supreme Court's 2022 Dobbs decision. Constitutional amendments which would have allowed for late-term abortion failed to pass in Florida, Nebraska, and South Dakota this election day. While many pro-life politicians have softened their abortion stance since Dobbs, in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis is being applauded for his outspokenness against Amendment 4, which would have constitutionalized a so-called right to abortion and negated the state's heartbeat law.
This is allowing non-physicians to green-light abortions up until the moment of birth.
Leading up to Election Day, DeSantis held a number of rallies alongside pro-life medical doctors concerned about the health risks associated with Amendment 4.
We can all stand together and oppose an amendment that would permit unregulated abortion at any time during pregnancy, that would remove physicians from the decision-making process, and would even eliminate parental consent for our young girls.
During EWTN's live special election coverage, the CEO of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs, Dr. Christina Francis, underscored the role of those Florida doctors in dispelling abortion misinformation to defeat the amendment.
And we are just so proud of our more than 700 physicians and medical professionals who stood and boldly defended their patients and stood for life-affirming health care in the state of Florida to help people understand that induced abortion is not needed for women to receive good care.
57% of Florida voters voted in favor of the abortion amendment Tuesday night, but that fell short of the required 60% threshold needed to change the state's constitution. Over in the Midwest, Nebraska's pro-life success is being credited to a creative ballot strategy. The Cornhusker state had two dueling abortion amendments. Nebraska currently protects life starting around 12 weeks of pregnancy. Measure 434 would have maintained that law, while Measure 439 would have enshrined the right to abortion in the state constitution until the point of viability or even later. Nebraska's Catholic Conference encouraged the faithful to vote no on 439 and yes on 434.
If Initiative 434 can't beat Initiative 439 at the ballot, unfortunately, we might be left with Initiative 439, which I tell people is worse than Roe versus Wade.
Because the measures were mutually exclusive and Measure 434 got more votes, Nebraska's abortion law will continue to be limited to the first 12 weeks. Human Bishop James Conley of Lincoln, Nebraska, celebrated the win in a social media message, but said this victory is just the start.
Now, we have a lot of work to do because we really believe that the ultimate goal is to make abortion unthinkable, to wrap our arms and our hearts around those who are facing difficult decisions.
Up north, pro-lifers in South Dakota are also celebrating this week after residents defeated Amendment G. In a vote of nearly 60 to 40, South Dakota rejected the measure that would have established a so-called right to abortion. Kelsey Pritchard of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America lives in South Dakota and shared the pro-life sentiment with me from there on election night.
But I think in South Dakota, we are very pro-life, and we don't like mandated taxpayer-funded abortion. We don't like the removal of parental rights. And so in any of these states, if voters understand what they're voting on, they will reject these measures.
The bishops of South Dakota issued a statement following the defeat of Amendment G, saying in part, "We give thanks to God that South Dakota can continue to uphold parental rights, protect women from coerced abortions, and safeguard the health and safety of preborn children and their mothers." The United States continued to be a patchwork of abortion laws following the reversal of Roe v. Wade, but now three states have shown there is a way to defeat abortion at the ballot box. The Texas Panhandle city of Amarillo overwhelmingly rejected a proposition to make abortion travel illegal. The citywide ordinance would have declared Amarillo a sanctuary city for the unborn and allow civil lawsuits against anyone who assists a woman in getting an abortion out of state. Almost 60% of voters in the reliably red city rejected the measure. Texan women accounted for some 1,400 abortions in New Mexico in 2023. With nearly 95% of the vote counted as of this recording, West Virginia is poised to ban medically assisted suicide, euthanasia, and so-called mercy killing in the state. The amendment to the state's constitution is called Protection Against Medically Assisted Suicide, and it would prohibit people, physicians, and healthcare providers from participating in the practice. Though the vote tally is not yet finalized, the amendment appears headed toward passage with a razor-close vote just over 50%. There is so much to discuss about this election from a Catholic perspective. Our panel is here with analysis when EWTN News in Depth returns. Welcome back to EWTN News in Depth as we continue our coverage of the 2024 U.S. election. Momentous changes are afoot, and there is much to discuss from a Catholic perspective. We are joined now by Francis Meyer, a senior fellow in the Catholic Studies program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. His work focuses on the intersection of Christian faith, culture, and public life. And Madeline Kearns is associate editor at the Free Press. She was previously a staff writer for National Review. Thank you both for joining us during what's been a historic election week. First, I want to get your initial reaction and thoughts to the results we saw just days ago. Fran, I'll go to you first.
I was astounded. I guess I've trained myself to be a pessimist, and so I went into the election evening fearing the worst, but it turned out extremely well, so I'm very happy.
I think a lot of people are surprised by just the overall results. Maddie, what's been your initial reaction to this election week?
Well, I had deja vu from 2016 and just reminded of how wrong the polls can be. Everyone was hedging. They thought it was going to be super close. It ended up not being close at all. We saw this massive red shift in 49 out of the 50 states and DC. They shifted Republican, meaning Trump did much better than he did in 2020. There was also a really astonishing diversity among voters. Trump's gained support from virtually every group, every minority group, whites and Hispanics, blacks, Asian voters, you name it. I think he had the best performance among the Jewish vote in a Republican perhaps ever. Mm. So, yeah, really astonishing. And I shared Fran's surprise. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of support for Trump, the Washington Post's exit poll reveals that Trump won the national Catholic vote by a 15-point margin, 56 to 41. I'd like to dig into that a bit. Fran, this has to go beyond the fact that Kamala Harris skipped the Al Smith charity dinner, right? What do you make of this exit poll finding?
Well, I think practicing Catholics tend toward the Republican Party anyway, not because necessarily of its economic policies, but because it's just more friendly to religious faith. I think that was accelerated in this case, because the Democratic candidate was so obviously secular and disinclined to make any concessions to religious freedom issues. And I think that's one of the reasons, aside from the usual resistance to abortion on the part of practicing Catholics, for the results that that happened.
Maddie, the Catholic vote shift represents a 10-point swing in favor of Trump from 2020 to 2024. Why do you think we're seeing this?
Well, part of the obvious explanation is that Biden is a Catholic, and obviously he's a Catholic who's breaking with the church's teachings on key issues such as abortion, but it's clear he has a sincere faith and he made that part of his campaign. This time, as Fran says, you've seen the opposite. You saw Kamala Harris really just snub Catholics, not just with the Al Smith dinner, but in terms of her rhetoric on abortion, her intolerance for religious exemptions to her extreme abortion agenda. And so, yes, that's going to be off-putting to Catholic practicing Catholics. But even to non-practicing Catholics, I think it is significant that Trump moderated his stance and the party stance on abortion. Obviously, this is to the disillusionment of practicing Catholics, but it did have an effect, and the desired effect, if you're talking purely in terms of political strategy.
I want to dig into that momentarily. But first, Fran, you wrote an article for The Catholic Thing this week in which you shared that you did vote for Trump. And you also wrote, this election's a reminder that we as Catholics need to live differently, that we need to remember we're a people set apart for the sake of the culture around us. Can you expand on what you mean by that?
Well, I think we can take a lesson from the Jewish community. They're a very creative minority in the culture, but they always remind themselves who they are as a separate people and cleave to their basic identity and beliefs. And I think we need to remember that that's our task as well. I mean, we're a people set apart. We need to behave that way. We have to contribute effectively to the culture, and I think we do that. But I think we have to be careful about mistaking assimilation and cooperation with just simply being digested by the culture around us. We have to remember, too, that, I mean, even a good Caesar, even a very good Caesar, is still Caesar. And Caesar's never a reliable ally. And so we need to live differently in the sense of living with a kind of an active, constant and active awareness that we're here and passing through for the next world. I mean, Augustine certainly had that attitude at a time very similar to our own, and I think we need to replicate that in our own lives.
That's a great reminder for us all. Maddie, you wrote what I consider a really smart article for the Free Press this week titled Democrats Picked the Wrong Women's Issue. And you say even though Democrats bet big on abortion this election cycle, you say the real winning issue was fighting off the encroachment of biological men into women's spaces and sports. Can you speak to how the gender issue really broke through this cycle?
Yeah, so you would expect from the way that Democrats were messaging their campaign that abortion was going to be a decisive issue. In fact, it wasn't. And it's in part because of the reason I just gave in the last answer, which is that Trump did moderate the party's position on abortion. So while support for abortion access has increased since the overturning of Roe versus Wade, in 2020, half of Americans supported legal access to abortion. In 2024, it was more like two-thirds. Even despite that, half of the people who say abortion should be legal in most cases voted for Trump anyway. So it ended up being a bit of a political flop among the electorate. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, the Democrats really lost out big on this transgender issue because Republicans spent $215 million in ads. They had done a lot of testing, message testing, and they had seen the difference that it could make when you make the case for female-only sports and spaces. And clearly, it had a big impact. I think it had a big impact, especially among men. We saw that dads were overwhelmingly in support of Trump this time around. I think that's got a lot to do with the sports issue. Nobody wants their daughter competing with biological males. And so, yeah, this was a big issue for them. And I'm sure we're going to see Democrats starting to change their messaging on the transgender issue going forward.
Fran, I want to follow up on Maddie's point. It's no secret that many pro-lifers were upset when Trump and Vance softened their pro-life stance this year. Yet it seems they still voted for the Trump-Vance ticket, and pro-choice people voted for Trump, too. CNN exit polls, as Maddie cited, found about half of people who say abortion should be legal in most cases supported Trump. What do you make of that?
Well, I think abortion wasn't the thing that people were thinking about primarily. I mean, the Democratic Party tried to make it the salient issue, but it's simply not. In terms of pro-lifers, I mean, I think reasonable pro-lifers understood that when you have a culture that's had 50 years of catechesis on the importance of abortion as a reproductive right, you're going to change people's opinions. We're now dealing with an environment that has to be recatechized, and that's a very long-term generational issue. So frankly, that didn't surprise me at all. I suspect I agree with Maddie on this, that this is, you know, the Vance comments and the comments of the Republican candidate who were running for president were made perfect sense. I mean, they were simply adjusting to the reality on the ground. And I don't think it really demonstrates a betrayal of the pro-life movement. I mean, the commitment that Trump had to the pro-life movement was always basically a deal to get the right kind of justices in. I didn't expect any more from him than that. He's more sympathetic to our position than the Democratic Party, but he's not fully on board, and I never thought he was, but he's better than the alternative.
Matt, I wanted to give you the opportunity to share if you had any additional thoughts on specifically how the abortion issue played out in the campaigns and ultimately in the polls. Was Harris's abortion stance just seen as too extreme?
I think that's exactly what it was seen as. I mean, it's no secret that Joe Biden's always been uncomfortable with abortion. I know he went with his party in recent years, but he's described himself as being not a fan of abortion, whereas Vice President Harris is very much a fan of abortion. She distinguished herself as the first sitting vice president to attend an abortion facility. She's made no offers of compromises when it comes to religious exemptions. She was also unable to answer a very basic question, which is, do you support any term limits whatsoever? She could not answer that question. And so, of course, compared to her, Trump is the obvious choice if you are a single issue pro-life voter.
Fran, for the first time since Roe v. Wade was overturned, there were states that were able to block pro-abortion amendments. We saw that in Florida, Nebraska, and South Dakota. Does that make you hopeful that we can continue to have pro-life successes in this post-Dobbs era that we're in?
Yes, but again, it's a generational issue. I think the pro-choice, pro-abortion movement in Florida spent $118 million and still lost. So we can win under very difficult circumstances, but they've got an enormous amount of money in pushing the abortion agenda, and that's just going to make the task very difficult. It's not impossible, but it's difficult, and it's going to be a long-term generational war.
And Fran, I wanted to give you the opportunity just to share with our viewers this election week how amid all this political news and buzz, it is important. We have to keep our eyes on Christ to live differently, as you said earlier.
You know, one of the things that I've said this many times, but I've really struggled with anger. We all have a particular sin in our lives that we deal with, and I tend to be prone to anger. And one of the things that's helped me deal with that, the frustrations that build up when you're dealing particularly with political issues like campaigns like the current one, is just going back to confession, to adoration, and to reading scripture on a regular basis. Those things which are simple and seem unimportant in the sense that, you know, you're not organizing a committee and you're not changing the world. You're changing yourself, though. And when you change yourself, that has a ripple effect on the people around you. So simple things like that, I think, reorient you toward why we're in the world and what our purpose is as believers. And that's where you need to begin a revolution. With the revolution in your own way of looking at things. I really highly recommend it because it's worked for me.
Thank you for that. Again, that's what is most important as well. We so appreciate it. Fran and Maddie, thank you for joining us. I know we'll continue to sift through these results as they continue to come in, but grateful to have you both this election week. Thank you.
Yeah, many thanks.
Headlines are next in the Week in Review. The end of a weeks-long strike at the aerospace giant Boeing tops the Week in Review. It was the costliest strike in the United States in the 21st century.
A lot of people say is, you know, no one walks away from a negotiation happy, but I am happy with the result that happened today.
This is better than our last offer, but I think they can do a little bit better. But we need to get back to work.
Factory workers' reactions to the deal were mixed after more than 30,000 of them voted to accept the new contract on Monday. The new contract offers a 38% wage increase over 4 years, an improvement from previous offers, but still shy of the union's demand for 40%. The machinists now return to work at Boeing's Pacific Northwest assembly lines, but the aerospace company's other problems are far from over. Boeing continues to grapple with financial woes and a quality crisis after a door plug blew off of a plane in January. The Federal Reserve cuts its key interest rate on Thursday. The lowered rate will impact Americans who borrow money through credit cards, personal loans, and auto financing. This is the second time the Fed has lowered the rate this year and signals inflation could finally be under control. The Fed lowered interest rates by a quarter point. This follows a half-point reduction in September. This moves the central bank's benchmark rate to 4.6%, down from a two-decade high of 5.3% before September. The Federal Reserve will hold its next meeting on December 18th. Massive protests in Israel after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ousted Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant this week. The move to fire the popular official was a surprise and came as the country fights its enemies on multiple fronts. Protesters chanted shame, shame outside Netanyahu's house in Jerusalem on Wednesday night. In his announcement on Tuesday, Netanyahu said he fired Gallant over a crisis of trust. The two disagreed over key issues. Gallant called for a ceasefire and a hostage deal, while Netanyahu wanted to continue pressure on Hamas. Gallant also wanted to scrap a controversial exemption for ultra-Orthodox Jews from military service. Israel Katz, Israel's foreign minister and a longtime loyalist to Netanyahu, will replace Gallant. The entire island of Cuba in darkness for the second time in a month after Hurricane Rafael decimated the power grid Wednesday. The Category 3 storm wreaked havoc on the country, causing dangerous flash flooding and leaving a trail of destruction and debris. Cuban authorities began restoring power to the eastern half of the island on Thursday, though the capital of Havana remained without power. Cuba has faced chronic power outages throughout the summer due to a shortage of petrol. Hurricane Rafael comes just weeks after one of the island's major power plants failed, causing the worst blackout in years. This Saturday is the 35th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. The Iron Curtain divided the German city for decades, and its destruction ultimately led to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of communism in Europe. And behind it all, a Polish pope. Pope St. John Paul II played an instrumental role in the tearing down of the wall and spent much of his early pontificate fighting against communism. After his election, he began working behind the scenes to help suppressed opponents of the communist dictatorship. He also consecrated the Soviet Union to the Immaculate Heart of Mary in 1981, following the call of Our Lady of Fatima. One of his most significant contributions was supporting the Solidarity movement in Poland, which stood up against the communist state. Martin Rottweiler, founder and director of EWTN Germany, says the saint's impact is undeniable.
If anyone had any doubts about it, the best witness is Mikhail Gorbachev, the then general secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, who himself testified that without John Paul II, this revolution would probably not have taken place, or at least not in this peaceful way.
There is more to this story and more from Martin on the fall of the Berlin Wall on the EWTN program Vaticano, Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern. A mission of service. Archbishop William Laurie, head of the Archdiocese of Baltimore and the Supreme Chaplain of the Knights of Columbus, recently traveled to Ukraine to meet with victims of the ongoing war and to offer his support to the work of fellow knights there. Though a short trip in October, the Archbishop met with displaced people and handed out coats to children. He also made a stop to pray for the deceased in Bucha, where hundreds of civilians were found dead early into the war in 2022. And the Baltimore Archbishop blessed an ambulance donated by the Knights of Columbus to be used at a local hospital. It's National Vocation Awareness Week in the United States, a moment to celebrate the vocations of priests, deacons, and religious, as well as a chance to renew our prayers and support for those who are discerning. Mother Olga of the Sacred Heart shared her message to young women considering religious life during a visit to the EWTN News Bureau this week.
Don't be afraid because you are not alone. You are not the one who is doing the work. if you give him permission and give him access, Mother Teresa used to say to her sisters, give God permission. If we give him permission, there is nothing we should be afraid of.
You may remember Mother Olga from her previous appearances on our program, and she has a beautiful vocation story of her own. Born in Iraq, Mother Olga lived through four wars in the Middle East. In 1995, she founded the First Order of Religious Sisters in the Assyrian Church in centuries before coming to the United States and entering into full communion with the Catholic Church. She ultimately founded the Daughters of Mary of Nazareth in Boston and opened Nazareth House, a house of discernment for young women. Up next on EWTN News in Depth, with the election of a new president, what will that mean for the hostages held by Hamas? When we come back, we get that view from the father of an American Israeli still held hostage. It's been more than a year since Hamas launched its terrorist attack on Israel, kidnapping 253 people. Almost 100 of them are still trapped in Gaza as negotiations for ceasefire and release remain at a standstill. According to Israeli authorities, more than 60 hostages are believed to still be alive and about 35 others dead. Four Americans are among the hostages still in captivity. With a new president soon taking the highest office in the U.S., the future of hostage negotiations remain uncertain. After election night, the families of those American hostages are calling on President Biden and President-elect Trump to work together to rescue their loved ones, saying that they need a bipartisan coalition of brave, committed leaders to bring them home. One of the Americans still being held hostage by Hamas is American-Israeli citizen Sagi Dekel-Hen. We are joined now by his father, Jonathan Dekel-Hen. Jonathan also happens to be a professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and he joins us now from Israel. Jonathan, it is a privilege to speak with you. Can you first tell us about your son, Sagi, about the man that he is and any information you might have about him at this point?
Sure. One small correction, if I may. There are actually seven U.S. citizens who are still hostage in Israel. Three that we know of have been murdered, but their bodies are being kept by Hamas, and four that we hope are still alive. Sagi is among those four. Mm. My son is now a 36-year-old father of three little girls. He and I both are dual citizens. He grew up, like the rest of my kids, on our kibbutz near Oz, which is on the border of Gaza, very rural area. It's for those listeners who aren't familiar with what a kibbutz is, it's a cooperative farm of people who sort of live, work, and live life together. Mm-hmm. Our community was a little over 400 people on October 7th, 2023. Sagi is, I guess, is the kind of son that any father would really want. Mm-hmm. He's an incredibly creative, loving, kind of ingenious young man. He has dedicated his life to helping communities. And the morning of October 7th, he was sort of on his latest pet project, which was to convert four old airport buses into mobile high-tech classrooms for underserved communities, for high school students in underserved communities in the south of Israel, which in general is a fairly underserved part of the country. Mm-hmm. And that was for Jewish and Bedouin students together. Mm-hmm. He is an incredible, well, you could say he's a guy by any means, but also loves his little girls. Mm. Tragically, he has yet to meet his youngest daughter. On the morning of October 7th, his wife, Avital, was 7 months pregnant when over 200 heavily armed, well-trained Hamas terrorists invaded our kibbutz, and together with several hundred looters from Gaza, most of them civilians, some of them not, rampaged through our home for the better part of 9 hours. Miraculously, Avital and the two girls were able to survive. Mm. She gave birth in mid-December to their third daughter, But of course, that was 2 months after Sagi was already taken hostage. Mm-hmm. In answer to your question, what we know, Sagi today is one of 29 hostages from our kibbutz alone, among the 101 Israeli hostages still being held by Hamas in Gaza. We know from the first hostage exchange in late November, early December, of those 100 or so hostages, women and children who were released by Hamas, about 40 of them were from our kibbutz. Mm-hmm. And some of the women and a couple of the teenagers were able to report to us that they had seen, encountered Sagi in the tunnels under Gaza very, very briefly just before they were released. Mm-hmm. And so we do have that confirmation. Oh. But that was an eternity ago.
Absolutely.
And that alone doesn't really give us all that much confidence. Mm-hmm. Because while they were telling us who they had that they had encountered Sagi, they had also encountered many, many other male hostages from the kibbutz, some of whom we know for absolute fact were murdered subsequently by Hamas or died from neglect by Hamas or a tragic result of friendly fire. So whatever we did know in early December is it's really not all that useful right now about his fate and the fate of all the hostages.
I can't fathom what this past year has been like for you and your family. And Jonathan, the big news in the U.S. this week is that Donald Trump will be the 47th president. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was among one of the first world leaders to congratulate Trump on his victory. I'm curious, how do you think a Trump administration will impact the Israel-Hamas war in the negotiations to release the hostages?
Well, I think the most important factor, really, is that President Trump will only take office on January 21st, I believe. And we have every reason to believe the hostage families and, you know, most Israelis, that the hostages who still might be alive, and we really don't know how many might still be alive, will not survive until January 21st. So whatever, if there is a chance of getting the hostages out overall, those who might still be alive and those who have already been murdered, it has to happen before January 21st. Mm. And therefore, the six U.S. hostage families that represent seven hostages, as you said, just issued a call really to both the incoming and the outgoing administrations to seize this moment. In which, you know, both of them can fully engage in this without any domestic politics or in sort of horse trading or credit taking coming into play, to simply get this done, to apply whatever pressure they can. And the U.S. has a lot of levers here, on not just on Israel and Hamas, but also on the intermediaries, on Qatar and Egypt and perhaps Turkey as well. Because simply, if we wait until President Trump and his administration go online, there in all probability will be no one to rescue alive.
And I know you've been in close communication with the Biden administration. You met with Biden last year. With my final minute with you now, Jonathan, if I may ask, how do you continue to hold on to hope? How are you maintaining strength, and any insight as to how the other families of hostages are doing?
Well, I don't think there's a universal answer to that question. I mean, I can just from within my family, you know, there are varying degrees or varying ways that we get through a day. And I would imagine it's the same way for all of the other families of the 101 hostages. I can just say for myself that what gets me out of bed every day and drives me is the absolute obligation and commitment that I have to get Sagi home to his four girls, his wife and three young daughters. And I cannot rest until that happens, as well as all of the other hostages, getting them home to their children, their parents, their wives, their husbands. This is a crisis in Israeli society, but I believe it's also a world crisis, because if Hamas is successful in not giving back the hostages, in letting them die in their tunnels, it's a very bad sign for the world. And God help us all if that is the outcome of this horrific situation.
Jonathan, please be assured that we join our prayers with you, and we thank you for taking the time to share Sagi's story and your family's story as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Next, we explore the rich artwork inside churches built more than 100 years ago by Czech and German immigrants to America. The famous Painted Churches of Texas, when we come back. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, thousands of Czech and German immigrants came to Texas to start a new life. Along the way, this largely Catholic population built dozens of churches across the state. Though ordinary on the outside, they had magnificent artwork on the inside. Monse Alvarado takes us to Texas to see the famous Texas Painted Churches.
Polka, Romanesque architecture, and German beer. What sounds like the makings of a small European village are staples of this historic community in Shiner, Texas.
What do I love about being pastor here? Well, the kolaches are not bad, right?
Apart from Czech pastries and their famous Shiner beer, Texas in this community also boasts being home to one of the 15 painted churches that draws tourists to rural Texas. The small Shiner community of about 2,000 people was founded in 1887, when German and Czech settlers started arriving at the promise of more farmland. Bringing more than their customs, the incoming immigrants brought their faith, with about 90% practicing Catholicism.
It's a very Czech community and very Catholic community here. My wife is, though. I did marry a Czech woman, so. There's this this tradition and this history of what this church means to this town, of the focus is Christ, right?
The central gathering place of the community was St. Cyril and Methodius Catholic Church, named after the two Greek saints who played a large role in evangelizing the Slavic peoples.
And so this construction on this church began in 1920, and it was completed in 1921. Everybody who worked on the church was local. So we still have parishioners that talk about their grandfather and their great-grandfather working on building this church.
Father Brian Heyer, the chaplain at St. Cyril and Methodius for the last 8 years, shares just how historic the Catholic community is in Shiner, which is expressed not only through the generational construction of the church, but also the cultural decoration. St. Cyril and Methodius is one of the latest painted churches in Texas, not painted until the 1950s, by a German-educated artist.
The artists that came to Texas were all European trained for the most part. So they're basically bringing their knowledge that they had and the work experience they had to Texas.
Bowie Harwood, author of Decorating Texas, Decorative Painting in the Lone Star State, studied these painted churches as a professor of interior design. In her research, she points out the Romanesque Revival architecture as well as the stenciled and freehand painted religious imagery throughout the church.
But the most impressive design statement is the huge panoramic mural located on the apse ceiling. It realistically depicts Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. Dark in value with an emphasis on blue and gray, the mural contrasts significantly with the lighter character of the interior, thereby contributing to a sense of religious awe.
A church that's been on the National Register of Historic Places since 1983, it's not just the paintings that make the church beautiful and historic.
We have stained glass windows, which are original from Munich in 1921. They're both in Czech and in German. And so that shows that the people were, one, supporting the parish together, donating to have their words put on the windows.
Deacon Michael Murkowski's family was one of those families with deep roots in the Shiner community.
Just like with the rest of these windows, you see different families' names on that have been part of the community for a long time. It was honoring their participation in this community through history.
As Father Brian reminds all visitors, it's not just the polka and pastries that holds this community together.
faith is something that brings us all together. It's a sign of unity, because the faith certainly is that. It's bigger than the 2,200 people that live here. And so that's why I love it. And that's why I get up in the morning and come and celebrate Mass. And it's just excited about our parish here in Shiner.
Montse Alvarado, EWTN News, in depth.
Such stunning artwork in those churches to glorify God. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.